Okay, so this is the November 15th, 2017 interview of Ellen Pope by Alexis DeBartolomeo for the Cooperstown Graduate Program Community Stories, recorded at Otsego 2000 in Cooperstown, New York. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Army. My mother is from here. She grew up in D.C., but she came here every summer. And her parents are from here, and she married a West Point graduate. And so we traveled all around the country and in Europe, well, Germany. And so every couple of years we moved around. But we always came back to Cooperstown for our summer vacation. So Cooperstown was always home to me. We were stationed in Washington, D.C., Kentucky, Alabama, Germany, three different places in Germany, Kansas, Missouri, and then back in D.C. several times.
So then with all that moving around, where did you go to school during those times?
The local public schools, the military schools, if we were on a military base that had schools, or the local Catholic schools.
And then how did your experiences as a young person shape your view of the environment?
Oh my goodness. I don't know that I was really aware of the environment as something to be protected until much later, I think college or later. It was just always very much part of life for me in the summer, especially the Cooperstown environment. This place is so gorgeous and very different from a Kansas military base like Fort Leavenworth or Alabama, where, frankly, in Alabama, the environment terrified me because they had poisonous snakes and spiders, and that's where I started Girl Scouts as a brownie there, and I will never go camping because it was so terrifying in that place. So it really wasn't a place I was that comfortable with until we would come up to Cooperstown, where my grandfather had a farm about 4 miles outside of Cooperstown, and it was just beautiful. So we would play in the fields and the streams and have fun with the cows, and he had sheep for a bit and chickens. So for me, it was always a very important element of my year, was to be able to come here and be on the lake and be in the fields and really enjoy this gorgeous place.
So even when you were abroad, you would still come back to Cooperstown?
Yes. Because, I mean, the Army would pay for trips back, I think twice a year or something like that. So we would always come back to Cooperstown.
So then when did you first become interested in policy?
Oddly enough, I think it was in sixth grade, which is kind of scary when you think about it. But we were in Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and my dad was at the Pentagon. And so I was at a small elementary school nearby. We had just moved there and right at the beginning of the school year, so I think maybe in October or November. And we had to do for school, we had to do a weekly notebook of, you know, things that happened during the week. And we had to design our covers and everything. And I remember designing a cover of Hubert Humphrey's death. You know, when he died, and I drew a cover. And it only struck me as odd after the fact. But I was always very keyed into what was going on policy-wise. And I don't know if it was because of, you know, my dad's role in the military, if it was because my grandparents were always talking politics. They lived in Washington. Or, you know, NPR was always on in the house. So maybe it was by osmosis. But it was where I felt most comfortable sort of gravitating toward. In high school, it was social studies and history. And then in college, it was political science was sort of an obvious major for me.
And then what first piqued your interest in environmental policy?
I think that was when I was at the German Marshall Fund. So I joined the German Marshall Fund in 96, maybe, 95? I'd have to get 96, maybe. And the German Marshall Fund had a strong environmental focus. It is a transatlantic policy organization. And they had a strong environmental focus. I joined to run their Marshall Memorial Fellowship Leadership Program. But much of the grant making that the German Marshall Fund had done over the previous 10 years had been to assist Europe with some of its technologies and on the environmental side, but also to learn from Europeans what they were doing with recycling and clean air emissions and all of that. So there was a very strong focus on the importance of the environment, especially in areas where there had been heavy industrialization and brownfield remediation. And I think that's when I really became aware of how important it was to really invest in protecting the environment, because I could see the impacts of it in Europe when I was traveling.
And then how has this shaped your career?
When I was at the German Marshall Fund, it was really sort of tangential because, again, I was running the leadership program, which really focused on policy across the board. It was from social policy to education policy to foreign policy, military policy. I mean, we really tried to give them a broad introduction to transatlantic or issues on the other side of the Atlantic. And so it really didn't affect me as much until I started the Comparative Domestic Policy Program at the German Marshall Fund, which was working with older industrial cities in the U.S. and also in Europe, who clearly one of their biggest issues is pollution, remediation, poor planning, sort of a deteriorated environment, natural environment, and how showing how European cities had really invested in the environment as a critical part of urban planning. And how they were able to use innovative technologies and strategies to bring back blighted areas that had, contaminated soils, water, etc., and bring those back and make them a welcoming part of their city and really an important part of their city. So that's when it really struck me that the environment was really at the base of, all that we know and love about a place. It's really the environment is the critical piece. The people can't thrive unless they have a healthy environment. The city doesn't function well unless there's a healthy environment. So that's sort of what it sort of struck me that this is important.
And then how did you get involved in conservation work?
I'd been working at the German Marshall Fund for about 12 years. And before that, I'd been at the French American Foundation for 5 years. So, close to 20 years traveling back and forth across the Atlantic kind of was taking its toll on me. And at the same time, my whole career had been connecting people working on these issues to get them to exchange ideas. So I was not really involved in the ideas or the environmental policy. I was connecting people who were. And it's an important role. I love doing that. But at some point I thought, this is a chance when the ATSIGO 2000 job came available. This is a chance to actually walk the talk, to really see, what it is like trying to make a change at the local level and not be the person who's just getting people to talk, but actually getting in there and trying to solve problems. So it sort of pushed me. It's like, okay, so now it's time for me to get in there.
And so what made you become involved internationally with your work? Like, what first sparked that?
I was always drawn to Europe. I mean, because of our time in Germany, we were there for 5 years when I was in my, I think it's kindergarten, preschool through second grade. And so languages have always been easy for me. I went to a Catholic school when we were stationed in Missouri. That was a French order of nuns, and so French was required. And I had a little old nun who insisted that we learn, and she insisted that we come on Saturdays for 3 hours to participate in the National French Contest. And that was easy to me. The language was easy to me, and I always wanted to go back to Europe and to have an international career. So that's one aspect I miss a little bit here. I don't miss the jet lag. I miss sort of the intellectual stimulation of dealing with completely different cultures and navigating completely different cultures. But it's always been part of who I wanted to be.
Would you ever consider going back over to Europe?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I try to do vacations there when I can. And, you know, if it weren't for family here, I'd probably be living in France.
So then what kind of problems have you run into while working internationally?
What kind of problems? What do you mean by problems? I mean, I don't know that I find them as problems per se. I find them as challenges.
Okay.
Problems. I don't identify them even as challenges. It's just fun. I mean, there's always the not quite knowing how to navigate a new culture. There's the language barrier to some extent, but I've found that if almost everybody in Europe speaks English to some extent, they if they don't speak English, because I speak French, some Italian, I understand Spanish, and I have a few words in German, you know, that I can navigate, I can get around, and we can usually get beyond any language barriers. I find, you know, living in Europe and working in Europe just a lot of fun. So it's not a challenge per se. I'm very comfortable in that culture, in those cultures, I should say.
And then have you ever faced any sort of resistance within your career?
Oh, sure. There's, you know, what's in the news right now is a lot of the gender dynamics, to put it kindly. I wouldn't say it's sexual harassment per se. I mean, I think we've all had the lecherous old men kind of thing. But that's not been to the point where I felt like I was persecuted or attacked or assaulted. But there is definitely in the policy world, the think tank world in DC when I was there, was still very male dominated and very much of a good old boys network. And even within my organization, the German Marshall Fund, where, you know, one of my staff who reported to me was best buddies with the president of the organization and and my direct boss. And so they would go off golfing when I really needed him to be doing work, but then I would get blamed because the work wasn't done. But they'd be like, oh, don't worry about it. You're just being a, you know, hyper-feminist. And that was incredibly frustrating. There was also significant pay disparities within the organization. And that was true for a number of the think tank organizations. If you were a man, you got paid a lot more. I had a German supervisor at one point. We were hiring a program officer and who was a man, really nice guy, very qualified, and he had requested a salary that was, I think, equivalent to mine. And my supervisor said, well, I think we need to give him this. And I said, so you'll be giving me a raise then, right? And he said, well, no, that's not in the budget. And I was like, but this isn't right. So I had to really fight for that kind of parity and equality, and after a while it was just tiring.
How did you overcome all of this or handle all of this?
You don't really. I mean, at that point I was just like, this is ridiculous. I mean, I would make my feelings known, but I knew I wasn't alone in the organization. But we had a CEO who was a difficult personality, and after a while you just get tired of fighting. So, and I just, at that, it sort of coincided with me wanting to come up here and just get out of the DC rat race altogether, because I started looking at, well, what do I want to do after GMF? And there really wasn't anything in Washington that I wanted to do. I was sick of the Washington scene. So it was a change of scene. I wanted to be in a rural area. I wanted to have a better life balance, and where I wasn't spending 2 hours a day commuting in bumper-to-bumper traffic. And, you know, where I'd have a chance to enjoy the outdoors, explore some hobbies, you know, that kind of stuff. So it really sort of coincided with, okay, I've done that. It was great. I will always be comfortable in Europe. And now I'm ready for a new challenge.
So then in 2010, you came to the Cooperstown area. Tell me about your decision to relocate here.
Well, I decided in 2007, I bought my house here. So I'd already been working on this sort of exit plan from GMF for a while. And I'd been looking at houses in Maine, because I have friends in Maine. I love Maine. But I kept gravitating back toward Cooperstown because of my family roots. And so I ended up buying a dilapidated pile on Elm Street that's a rental property. And, the apartments were rented, so I wasn't in a hurry to move up here. But I had this dream that, oh, I'll just buy the house. It'll be great. It'll be so quaint. And I'll have that income, and then I'll start a business on Main Street. I'll start a little retail business. And then I realized that I needed an income to do, to tide me over while I was doing that, so that plan fell apart. But I had the house, and so I would come up on the weekends to take care of the house and to start rehabbing bits of it. And at the same time, some family friends introduced me to Otsego 2000, and asked me to join the board, so I did. I think I'd applied for the job for the executive director, but they were already so far down the process with somebody else that they interviewed me out of politeness, I think, because I was I knew many of the board, but they had given it to somebody else. So I resigned myself to, well, life is better at GMF, so I'll just continue there. And then after about a year or two, they decided, the board asked me to consider taking on the position. And it took me about 3 months to make the commitment, which drove my board president crazy, I think. But when I finally made the decision to move away, I kicked myself for not making it earlier. But it was, I had sort of put the cart before the horse by buying the house and then thinking, oh, right, I need an income. That's the problem. That's the missing piece. So then here I am.
So could you tell me a little bit about the history of Otsego 2000?
Yeah, it was founded in 1981, first as an organization called Friends of Protect. And Protect is an acronym, and I have no idea what it stands for. Because I haven't figured out what the actual acronym could possibly mean. And the name was changed in 1983 to Otsego 2000. But it was founded to protect the Otsego Lake sort of region and immediately around Otsego Lake from a major power line that was planned for running right down the east side of the lake on top of the hill. The power line was moved a couple valleys to the west. It's now in the Butternut Valley. It's the Marcy South power line. So they succeeded in getting it off of Otsego Lake, which we were founded by the great-great-grandson of James Fenimore Cooper, who felt that this landscape was really critical to Americans' notions of environmentalism and the importance of nature in the U.S., because Fenimore Cooper had really brought that issue to the fore in the 19th century. We were founded to protect the lake and really focused on sensible planning, intelligent planning, zoning, regulations that would protect water quality, that would protect the scenic landscape, the historic landscape around the region. So we were founded to respond to a threat. And so that's still our first and foremost responsibility, is responding quickly to a perceived, or actually to real threats to the region, whether it's the fracking, which was our biggest threat ever, a huge windmill farm that was going to go at the other end of the lake in Cherry Valley. It was going to be about 60 windmills, which in retrospect is a small wind farm compared to how big the turbines are nowadays. And And now, you know, the XNG, what they're calling bomb trucks, they're compressed natural gas trucks that are going along Route 205, which is not designed for highly flammable explosive trucks. And then also things like motorboat launch on Otsego Lake that would have changed the character of Otsego Lake immeasurably if we'd allowed the state to put that in. I feel like there are other things. One of the tools that we discovered along the way was using the incredible historic fabric of this region to protect it. The Glimmerglass National Historic District was sort of created out of a movement to find a tool that would ensure additional review for any major planning projects that would go in this area. Because New York State law allows, and I think federal law, if a property or a project is located in a historic district or is listed on the National Register, there's an additional layer of review for any Department of Transportation project or public works project or any development that would involve federal or state monies, grant monies or tax credits or loans. And that's been a very important tool for protection in this area. We have 36,000 acres, more or less, in the county that are now listed on the National Register. It's still only about 1% of the county. But we were able to use that argument in our comments to the DEC on the gas drilling, on the fracking. And they cited that as one adverse impact that fracking could have on upstate New York or on New York State resources in their denial of the process, when they banned the process. So that was really, I think, a significant win for us. So that's sort of what have done over the, you know, in terms of protecting the area. At the same time, we try to build up programs and initiatives that add to the community life, like the farmers market, like our Otsego Outdoors website, and Glimmerglass Film Days most recently.
So then, what is your approach to educating the public about environmental issues?
We do it through a variety of ways, you know, through the various e-blasts, Facebook, which is new tools. I mean, we didn't use that back in when I first came to Otsego 2000. I only did Facebook grudgingly, but it's an incredibly useful tool. But then we also hold meetings. We organize public meetings. For the fracking issue, we had probably every couple of months we would show either a film or have a town hall meeting in different communities. We would go to town board meetings, planning board meetings, and speak up about the process, the threat, what it would be doing to that town, and what the town needed to do to protect itself. So we would send postcards. We did a survey. We helped all the towns around the county do surveys of their population. And I'm not talking we're helping the municipalities. We helped the grassroots neighborhood groups in those towns. So they weren't municipally sanctioned surveys. But it really helped to gauge people's opinions on what their town was facing. And overwhelmingly, the county was against it. So, you know, you use sort of the public relations campaigns by mailing letters to every voter or every property owner. And letters to the editor. There's so many layers and ways to get the information out to people.
Which way did you find to be the most beneficial?
I think it was the postcards. And then when it came time to submit comments to the DEC on their revised draft, because we had commented on the first one and along with several other groups in other parts of the state, that caused them to withdraw that draft and issue a revised draft, which incorporated some of the suggestions. but not all of them by any means. And they gave us 30 days to respond. They released it right before Christmas. You know, it was a timed to be a problem. I mean, to limit comment. And then they released the regulations at the same time, draft regulations, which is out of the ordinary, because normally you have this environmental impact statement before you can draft regulations. So they did both simultaneously, which meant a lot more work for everybody. So we had some experts who are phenomenal people, Lou Alstadt and Keith Hsu, who read through everything and drafted 20 separate comment letters that we were able to, on different aspects of where the EIS was deficient. And we used those to hold comment letter writing parties. And what was most effective about that, we also distributed them on thumb drives to people so that they could then take them and share them with friends. But what was most effective about those was not necessarily the volume of letters we generated, which was huge, but it was the fact that people took the time to read the letters that they were signing and then shared them with friends. And then, so that it was another way to disseminate information and draw attention to this very real threat. And I think that was really effective because, you know, having a letter writing party in Gilbertsville and in Morris and in Westford and Cherry Valley, you know, where everybody gets together, they feel like they're not alone. And they discuss the concerns. We have people there who can respond, you know, to their questions and all that, but they feel like they're doing something. And then they're more invested in the outcome. And so then they show up for protests and they call their state representatives, they call the DEC. You know, it just becomes highly effective.
So tell me about ATSIGO 2000's approach to advocacy.
Well, I think I just covered all of that. I mean, because I think that's the key, is getting the person who's not what I might call an armchair who is like an armchair activist. And I would put myself in that category because I'm not naturally someone who goes out and waves signs and holds up banners. But to get them to see how their participation can have a real impact, and that it's important that everybody shows up at the table. And you can do it in different ways. You can be the one chaining yourself to a fence, or you can be the one calling the governor's office every day, or once. But, you know, whatever you can do, you have to do something. And I think people really appreciated that they, you know, we were asking them to do something. And whatever they were able to do in their comfort zone, and maybe just slightly out of their comfort zone, just push it a little bit. But we alone, ATSIGO 2000, can't succeed in this. We need everybody else to jump in. We can lead the way. We can help with resources. And we did a lot of that. We did a lot of photocopying for the neighborhood groups. We did a lot of the formatting of postcards and paying for postage. And, you know, we would raise money and people would give us $5 for postage. And we could do the process, but they needed to get the voice out, because only by hearing from a gazillion people will there be a response. If they just keep hearing from the same three people, they just brush it off.
So then what kind of role did you play in the local hydrofracking debates?
Well, I think, again, I think I just covered all of that. That was, we were early on, we raised the alarm about this. As we got deeper and deeper into what the fracking process was and what impact it could have on water and land and a community character, all of that, we became increasingly alarmed. And ATSIGO 2000 is lucky in that we have what we call the Cooper Fund for Environmental Stewardship, which was established. We had a gala dinner on Henry Cooper's 75th birthday, I think, and it raised a sort of a nest egg of, or a rainy day fund, which allows us to respond quickly if we see a threat coming. So we don't have to do a fundraiser to be, you know, in order to act. We can act and then reach out to the community to help with the costs.